It's an honour, as always, to be here at Greenbelt. By the Sunday afternoon, I'm feeling pretty muddy and thinking no one will mind if I smell, because they probably all do too by now, except for those lucky people who are here for the day and walking around looking really stylish or staying in hotels in Cheltenham or something. But it's really good to be here. When I started writing Digital Revolutions, I mentioned to some friends I'd got a contract to write a book about activism and the internet. And for some of my friends who know me well, this caused some confusion, because they sort of paused and said, "You're writing a book about technology. Have you worked out how to use your DVD player yet?" Because I'm not, you know, I'm not a technologically minded person. But I've been using the internet for a long time, since 1998. Not that early, really. A lot of people are using it earlier still. But it's when I became a student. And, you know, it seemed an exciting way of communicating. I know a friend of mine first came across it when a friend of his said, "We've got the internet at home. It's really good. You could talk to girls in America." But I discovered when I was quite young that when I wasn't up to much verbal communication because of my mental health not being too great, I could talk online. And indeed, I could talk with other people whose mental health was not so good. And that was very empowering, but I still never got very technological. So what I've been excited about and what I've written about is the way that the internet has been used by ordinary grassroots people, not technological experts, not hackers or organised professional digital campaigners, important though that is, but just by ordinary, regular people. So the book isn't about technology. It's a book of stories. It's about activism in the last few years, mostly 2008 to 2012, around the world. And it's been an exciting time for activism, because in 2008, of course, we had the financial crash. The truth was exposed of a system that the rich benefit from at the expense of the rest of us. And the rest of us have fought back. We've seen the mixed but inspiring events in North Africa, the fall of dictatorships, the Occupy movement and Indignados movement, protest camps springing up. Suddenly, with UK Uncut and Uncut internationally, there's been a global movement against tax dodging. There's been another global movement against sexual violence. There's been record-breaking levels of involvement in activism in Greece and Israel and Quebec and elsewhere. But all that, of course, is in the context of there being quite a lot to be campaigning against, in the context of austerity and injustice and many campaigns that are not doing so well or not being so successful. You'll notice I've got my phone on the lectern, and that isn't because I'm doing something cleverly complicated and digital, it's just so I know what the time is. When writing the book, and since, I've discovered there's broadly two views on the role of the internet in activism. So at one extreme, you've got people who say that the internet is the future, this is a social media revolution. So in Tunisia and Egypt, when there was rebellion there, you had, you know, Western commentators saying, "Oh, this, you know, clearly Mubarak's fallen because of social media." Now, perhaps they hadn't noticed that for the previous 10 years there'd been a resistance movement building in Egypt, using social media but other things as well. Perhaps they hadn't noticed that some of the resentment was caused by Mubarak's association with Western governments and with the Israeli government. And perhaps it was easier to focus on that than the fact that Mubarak had been armed by US and UK governments for so long. But then on the other hand, you've got the view that justice misses the internet. Evgeny Morozov, I've forgotten his name. Thank you. He's makes what basically amounts to a career out of dismissing the importance of the internet for activism. And Evgeny Morozov was dismissing the importance of the internet in Tunisia, even while Tunisian activists were talking about how helpful Facebook had been in allowing them to know that protests were going on elsewhere in the country, thus giving them confidence to have protests in their own towns when the state media was not reporting on it. So you've got these two extreme views. One says the internet's everything, one says the internet makes no difference. And they're both wrong. And they're both wrong for the same reason. They're wrong because they treat the internet as something exotic, something separate, something different from everyday life. The reality is people who need to resist will use the tools that are there. People who need to communicate will use the tools that are there. And now about a third of the world's population have internet access. A friend of mine's just moved to the Falkland Islands, which has the highest rate of internet access in the world. I asked her if that was because there wasn't much to do on the Falkland Islands, but that got a rather negative reaction. So I'm sure there's other good reasons for it. However, we have to remember two-thirds of the world's population do not have access to the internet. So this isn't something that is universal. I'd like to tell you a couple of stories that illustrate different ways in which the internet has been used or not used in activism recently. Now, the first one concerns Ian Duncan Smith. So good they named him thrice. Our work and pension secretary. A man whose attitude to welfare is inspired by a different interpretation of Christianity to mine. But some of you will remember a few months ago, Ian Duncan Smith appeared on the radio, and the Today programme had interviewed a man who was left to live on £53 a week by the welfare state. And Duncan Smith was asked, could you live on £53 a week? And he said, if I had to, I would. Anyway, I was really angry when I heard it. So were lots of other people. But like most people, I didn't do anything about it. But one man went online and started a petition calling on Ian Duncan Smith to live on £53 a week for a year. You know, now, you're probably, I'm guessing most of you, get lots of emails asking you to sign online petitions all the time. Who's been asked to sign an online petition in the last week? In the last day? That's because you're a greenbelt and there's still some hands up. And some of them, let's face it, are more effective than others or get more support than others. But this petition, I'd heard about it in the morning, I'd signed it, and then during the day, I thought about it a bit later on, and I went online, and I noticed it had got up to, by early evening, it was something like 60,000 signatures. You know, I've signed petitions and been pleased to get a few thousand after a few weeks, and this, 60,000 signatures by early evening. And then I kept checking back, and then I was sort of, a bit late on in the evening, I was sort of winding down and getting ready to go to bed, and it was 80,000 signatures. It was going up at a rate of more than 1,000 signatures a minute. I said to my flatmate, it's 80,000 signatures, and then, I carried on getting ready for bed, and then I looked again, and then I came back into the living room and said, it's 86,000 signatures. And a bit later, it's 90,000 signatures. She said, I thought you were going to go to bed early today. I said, I'm not going to bed till it's 100,000 signatures. Anyway, it was on 100,000 just before midnight. It was 400,000 signatures a few days later when it was handed into Downing Street and when change.org announced it was their fastest growing petition in the history of their website and possibly the fastest growing petition in the history of the world. But, of course, Ian Duncan Smith hasn't taken the 97% drop in his income that would be required to fulfil the request of the petition. But what the petition has done, by gaining that publicity, by appearing on the front page of The Independent and The Daily Mirror the next day, an online petition as a front page news story, what it has done, it's acted as a piece of satire. It's held up a mirror to the situation and said, look, the people in power do not live the way that the people who they are controlling, who they are making rules for, live. They live on a different world. They don't really know what it's like. So it wasn't calling for a specific change. It was actually holding up a mirror. It was doing something much more imaginative. And it meant that amidst all these lies from the right-wing media that give impressions about how much people and benefits are living on, the figure of £53 had stuck in people's minds because of all that publicity. I'll go to another example of online activism, or perhaps I should say offline activism. And it goes back to the Arms Fair, the London Arms Fair in 2011, which happened in September of that year, as it does every 2 years. And I was involved in Campaign Against Arms Trade, and we discovered, some of my colleagues discovered, that the evening reception for arms dealers on the first day was going to be held at the National Gallery. And we didn't really think the National Gallery should be holding receptions for arms dealers. But we'd found out, and they didn't know that we'd found out, Now, we could have called a protest at the National Gallery, but the problem is, as soon as we announced that on Facebook, on email, anywhere, the National Gallery would know. They'd, you know, immediately go into defending it PR-wise, but also defending it physically. It would be very difficult to protest. I'm still very impressed with the staff of Campaign Against Arms Trade with what they did, because this was a context in which using the internet would have been dangerous. It would have undermined the campaign. So they called for a protest outside the headquarters of BAE Systems, the arms company, which is fine. BAE Systems headquarters just round the corner from the National Gallery. So I was one of the privileged few who was told the reasoning behind this, but most people turned up outside BAE not knowing about the gallery, and then we quietly passed the word around. And then people gradually, in twos or threes, walked off towards the National Gallery. And the National Gallery was just about to close. We should have timed it a bit earlier. And some of you know Chris Howson, Church of England priest, who's been speaking this weekend. Chris and I and one or two others sort of went into the gallery together. And it was a confused moment because I thought, oh, no, they're going to shut before we get there. And I was, you know, I was aware that the junior staff might be stressed by lots of people turning up as they're about to close. And I didn't have anything against them. I didn't want to inconvenience them. And, you know, Chris and I walked in and one of the staff said, "We are about to close, sir." And I remember Chris saying, "Oh, you know, I just want to see the cannelletti." And I thought, "Isn't that type of a pipe of pasta?" But it was, but whether it was or not, anyway, he went on, and eventually we were removed from the National Gallery. And I'm now pleased to report, a few months later, the National Gallery ended all relationships with arms companies and won't be hosting it at the Arms Fair this year. Now, thank you. And that's due not only to those of us who occupied it then, but the pressure that's been put on since, and those who we know within the National Gallery who were not happy about it, and many, many thanks go to them for working behind the scenes. But that was an example of a story where using the internet would have undermined what we were doing. And my third example of an online campaign is one of the ones that moves me and inspires me the most, because it is that rare thing, a campaign that is almost entirely online. And it began in Israel. It began in Israel, started by an Israeli activist called Ronnie Edry. Ronnie Edry logged onto Facebook in March 2002 and started a page called Israel Loves Iran. He started it because Benjamin Netanyahu had been hyping up the anti-Iranian rhetoric, turning attention away from domestic problems by stirring up war against Iran, just as the Iranian President Ahmadinejad was stirring up the anti-Israeli rhetoric, which was also helping to look away from domestic problems in Iran. Edry went online and simply posted, "Iranians, we love you. We, as in the people who represented, we will never bomb your country." And then he posted a message telling his government, "We are not ready to die in your war." "I never met an Iranian," said Ronnie Edry. "It's always the same here in the Middle East. We have so many enemies and we don't know any of them. I just wanted to check. The day-to-day people like me, are they feeling the same? Are they afraid?" And then somebody from Iran went on and founded a page called Iran Loves Israel. And they posted, "For there to be a war between us, first we must be afraid of each other. We must hate. I'm not afraid of you. I don't hate you. I don't even know you. War depends on people on both sides listening to their governments and not communicating directly with people who live in the other country." And I think it's exciting that the internet's ability to connect up ordinary people in countries can threaten the chances of war stirred up by those governments. But what I want to talk about now, having talked about some individual examples, is some of the ways in which the internet has affected bigger activist movements. I'm not sure whether to be distracted by the big thing or quite encouraged by it, sort of going on behind me here. It's quite enlivening. But we've seen a lot of movements, such as the Uncut movement and the Occupy movement, take off in recent years, a lot of discussion about the role of the internet in them. Some of you will be aware of the Uncut movement, involved people peacefully occupying shops such as Vodafone and Boots and Topshop and other shops accused of tax dodging, and of course Fortnum and Mason famously in 2011 when 145 of them were arrested. 145 of the protesters, not the directors of Fortnum and Mason, sadly. Tax dodging shot up the political agenda. It started being seen as an issue that everyone had to talk about, whereas previously it had been ignored. It gave the lie to the idea there was no alternative to the cuts. And what's interesting there is that the Uncut movement spread very rapidly. The Uncut movement, you know, originally people went to stores in London, hashtag on Twitter. For those of you who don't use Twitter, a hashtag is a way of identifying the main subject you're talking about. So you can put hashtag UK Uncut, hashtag tax, somebody searching for that subject will put in hashtag and you'll find the tweets that are about it. And then, of course, groups just sprang up. Suddenly there was Bradford Uncut and Glasgow Uncut and Cardiff Uncut and Cornwall Uncut, just spontaneously springing up. Most of them had no contact initially with the people in London who'd started it. And then there was Canada Uncut and France Uncut and eventually Sudan Uncut. And nobody had organised this. Nobody had sat in London and planned a global movement, contrary to some conspiracy theories you can read on right-wing blogs. Of course, movements in countries have always inspired movements in other countries, but rarely with the same name and the same sort of way of fitting into something, so it becomes a global network rather than a hierarchy. And the hashtag and Twitter allowed that to happen easier because you could declare yourself to be part of a movement with that hashtag. Same thing happened with the Slut Walk movement, some of you will be aware of. It was triggered in Canada when a policeman leading what was supposed to be a session on sexual violence, on tackling sexual violence, told students that they would stand less chance of being assaulted if they didn't dress like sluts. This two local feminists called Heather Jarvis and Sonia Barnett, I've forgotten her name. It was Heather Jarvis I interviewed. Bear with me a moment. Yes, Heather Jarvis and Sonia Barnett. My apologies to Sonia. Decided to have a march, and they'd call it a slut walk. They'd throw the word back at them. And at one point, Heather turned to Sonia and said, "Wouldn't it be great if 100 people turned up?" 4,000 people turned up. And before it had even started, there were other slut walks being planned around the world. Again, most of them without much initial contact with the people in Toronto. And that was, again, because of the hashtag revolution, the chance of this sort of global network of groups that identified themselves with each other without joining a formal organisation. And, of course, that's happened with the Occupy movement as well. There was the Indignados movement, indignant ones, in Spain and elsewhere, that inspired the Occupy movement in Wall Street and London and Hong Kong and so on. I sort of got involved in Occupy almost by accident when I wrote a piece for The Guardian encouraging St Paul's Cathedral to support Occupy. And then when St Paul's didn't, I suddenly found myself being contacted by occupiers who may have overestimated my influence within the Christian church to get support. But it does mean that along with several other Christians, I was dragged from the steps of St Paul's while praying during the eviction. But I was never uncritical of Occupy. I think Occupy had some problems. But one of the fascinating things about the Occupy movement is you had this real paradox. On the one hand, it was very technical, it was digital, it was being discussed online, it was being tweeted, it was being planned, you know, things were being planned on Twitter, hashtag Occupy, etc. On the other hand, it basically involved a load of people standing in public squares and discussing politics in the rain, quite often. In a way that, you know, everyone says, oh, politics now, it's all done on the telly and the internet. You know, if a few years ago you told me there's going to be this mass international movement, including in Britain, and a load of young people, mostly young people, others as well, from lots of different backgrounds, will gather in public squares and stand in the rain and talk about politics, I wouldn't really have believed it. But that's essentially what happened. What is the paradox between the online technical Occupy and the offline standing in the rain Occupy, when those two things work, and they didn't always work, but at their best, those two things, the internet and the public squares, are much more inclusive forms of politics than going into a polling station every 5 years, choosing between candidates who may not seem that different, and being allowed to watch Newsnight in between. It actually involves more people in more varied ways. When they work, and they didn't always work, and they were both abused at times, but when they worked, they involved people. And that's why Ian Chamberlain, a Quaker occupier, describes Occupy as a sort of marriage between the online and offline world. What's really interesting about activism in the internet age, looking at Occupy, is the way that some of those camps have tried to set up to show what they want the world to be like by the way they live. Consensus decision-making at camps because that's how they want the world to work. Sharing of food because that's how they want the world to work. And so on. And a lack of hierarchy, which was sometimes abused. There was, some camps were dominated by some people. Male domination of discussions was an issue in lots of places. There were various allegations of sexual abuse at Occupy Glasgow in particular. Certainly, protesters are not immune to the sins against which they protest. But this lack of hierarchy means that the sort of ultra-left Trotskyite groups that turned up at Occupy London to sell their newspapers in the early days rapidly gave up because they wanted to push a particular line, as certain Trotskyite groups tend to. And actually, it was far too messy for that. It was much more open to discussion and hearing different views and involving everyone to push a particular line. And in some ways, it's a different type of belonging. You no longer sign up and join a political party. You go along and join in, or you just sign up to a petition. I know, for example, I know Christianity Uncut, which I'm involved in. I know people who would say they're members of Christianity Uncut whose name do not appear on any records or mailing list held by Christianity Uncut because they've been to one of our actions, they've been to one of our events. It's a fluid membership. They feel part of it. And that's happening with churches as well. Christians should know about this more than anyone because what we've seen in the last few years in many denominations is that after years of falling attendance levels, attendance is now roughly levelling off. Declining slightly or increasing slightly or staying about the same, roughly levelling off attendance while formal membership is going down the pan. Because we've got lots of people attending but not joining. Across denominations, in politics as well, in campaigning, we have new ideas of what it means to belong, what it means to join, what it means to be a member. Now, we can debate whether those attitudes are good. We can debate the weaknesses in terms of a potential lack of commitment. We can debate the advantages in terms of individual integrity. But let's not pretend it isn't happening. What worries me is that it's talked about in churches and even politics as if it was two separate things. You know, we talk about in our church, we've got a problem with people not becoming members. And then, in politics, there's an issue about the way people don't join parties anymore. Rather than seeing across the board, there's this rejection of formal membership. And what does that mean for all of us? And I think that's a big question we all have to ask ourselves in the age of the internet, and particularly churches. Well, churches should be in a particularly strong place to talk about it because we've been experiencing it for longer. But mostly we don't seem to notice that it's been happening. Indeed, one of the things about the age of the internet and activism and commitment during it is that with this decline in formal membership, perhaps, and I appreciate there were people in the room who don't like this or disagree with me, which is fair enough, perhaps denominations and denominational structures are becoming less important, and what Christians are doing at the grassroots is becoming more important. I'm not saying denominations don't do good things. Some of them are doing great things. But I do see grassroots Christian groups such as Christianity Uncut and others that I'm not involved in doing good activism. And I also see some very right-wing Christian lobby groups such as Christian Concern and so-called Anglican Mainstream doing some far less appealing activism. In a way that perhaps, both right and left, is becoming is replacing over time what denominations might do. I don't know, it's a possibility, but we need to recognise this breakdown of formal membership. One of the downsides of that breakdown is that people might join in something, be a bit demoralised by it, not join in again. It's difficult to keep track of. But perhaps we have to have more trust in people, perhaps we have more trust in each other to keep going, more trust in the Holy Spirit to help keep us going. I'm going to finish talking in a minute because I wanted to make sure that half the session was questions and discussion. So if I've asked lots of questions and raised issues without giving too many answers, then I hope that means that there'll be as much space for you to give answers as for me. But one thing that I will mention is that the internet age doesn't always pose challenges that are that different to other ages. The challenges of injustice, of racism, of homophobia, of sexism, of economic and environmental exploitation are still there. And the motivations for fighting them, for resisting them, for creating something better, for moving towards justice, shalom, the kingdom of God, is still the same. We'll use the tools that are there, whether it's the printing press or the invention of Twitter, or just the chance to talk to each other and tell each other what we know. And so to finish, I'd like to finish with a mention of an activist who most of you have probably not heard of, who's rarely written about, and who sadly is unlikely to be remembered much. But he's somebody who I really want to honour. I never had the privilege of even hearing of him until after he was dead. Faisal Ahmed Abdullah Hadwas was a Saudi Arabian activist who, in the middle of the Egyptian uprisings, decided that Saudi Arabia needed an Arab Spring as well. And he went on Facebook and he posted a page on Facebook saying that on this particular date, there would be a peaceful demonstration against the regime. That demonstration didn't happen. And one of the reasons it didn't happen was because Abdullah Hadwas was murdered by the Saudi authorities before it could happen. Because he'd posted on Facebook, they weren't going to let him carry on with it. For that is the regime that Saudi Arabia is faced with. In 2 weeks' time, the regime of Saudi Arabia will be in London, representatives will be in London at the London Arms Fair this year, 2 years on from the occupation of the National Gallery. They'll be here with representatives from Bahrain and Colombia and Israel, and a few democracies that the government might talk about a bit more. Saudi Arabia continues to be a major recipient of British arms. And at that arms fair, as at many other occasions, Christians will be playing a part through non-violent direct action, through letters to MPs, through lobbying, through lawful demonstrations too, and through Twittering and Facebooking and so on. So we fought the arms trade, and we fought many other things without the internet. We've now got the internet and many other tools to do it. So my final request to you before I hand over is that if you've got time, and you might be fighting many other injustices, and I respect that, if you've got time, if you can send a tweet, if you can sign onto Facebook, if you can turn up at the Excel Centre in London to protest, the arms trade, one of the most vicious and dangerous things in the world today, is coming to celebrate in London, and we need to be there to resist it with all the tools that we have. Let us rejoice in the activism of the last few years. Let us be inspired by people in Saudi Arabia, people sleeping in tents in New York, and people who can't get out of their own houses but can send emails, sign petitions, and resist what's going on. Let us be there at the arms fair. Let us be there when we face injustice. And let us remember, in Martin Luther King's words, that our lives begin to end the day we stop talking about what matters. Thank you.
What Simon forgot to plug was his book as well.
My book. Cool. Yeah. So I forgot that.
So while I love that you just plugged being an activist, which is brilliant. How rarely does Greenberg actually tell you things to do when the festival's over? He's also signing books at 5:30 in the thing. So just to in case you forget to plug it later.
Oh, yeah. That's 5:30 in the book tip.
I have loads of questions, but I'm sure you must too. If you have one, come up, or if you don't, then I think I can run out and get you. So if anyone has questions and mobility issues, wave.
What's the book called?
Oh, Digital Revolutions.
The book is called Digital Revolutions, Activism in the Internet Age. It's published by New Internationalist. It's $9.99, or if for some reason you happen to be buying it in the United States, $16.95.
Yeah. So if anyone got any questions, let's come up.
I'm intrigued by the idea of the role of the internet in the demise of membership, and can you say more about that?
Yeah. Do you want me to answer as we go? Okay.
I was going to ask, the Kony 2012 campaign, millions of people signed a petition, it was huge. They called people out on the streets, nobody turned up.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Okay. The first question, the role of the internet in decline of formal membership. I think there are academics who could say a lot more about this than I can. I've sort of observed it anecdotally in that the internet allows people to feel like to do something that implies belonging without formally joining. So, for example, I was on the staff of Campaign Against Arms Trade from 2006 to 2009, which was around the time that sort of Facebook and so on was taking off. And the first time we called, it seems odd to think this was so only a few years ago, it was the first time we'd called a demonstration on Facebook, that we'd actually listed it as a Facebook event. And people turned up to protest against the Saudi king's state visit in 2007. And there were journalists going around interviewing them. And I remember talking to one woman. I said, you know, how did you hear about it? She said, oh, it was on Facebook. I said, you know, you're not like on the CAP mailing list or anything. And she said, oh, no. And then a journalist spoke to her and said, are you part of the Campaign Against Arms Trade? She said, oh, yes, because she was on the Facebook group. So I'm not saying the internet has done it, but the internet has played a role in helping people feel they can declare their belonging to something without formally joining. I suspect there's also more subtle things, such as the internet means you could sort of belong to a lot more things at once, and there's more subtle sociological things there about the sort of breakdown of narrow identities and people having more identities or belonging to more communities at once, because you know you're not just in your local community, you may be part of a community of people who are interested in a particular thing or have a particular issue they're struggling with online. I hope that helps. Regards to the second question about you do loads online and then you try and call people out onto the streets and they don't come, and I think that's a real issue. I think one of the example that was given of the Kony campaign, it was a very top down campaign. It wasn't a grassroots campaign. It got people doing things when requested, but there wasn't any sort of heart in it at the grassroots. And those sort of campaigns are unlikely to get anyone out onto the streets. I think if we're organising from the grassroots and the internet is part of what we do, that's fine. If we see the internet as like a step on the way to, you know, we're just going to use the internet and then we're going to get people out of the streets, I don't think that will work. Most people who sign online petitions won't come out onto the streets, and that's frustrating. But there's a danger of saying, oh, before the internet, these people would have come out onto the streets and now they just sign online petitions. I don't think before the internet most of those would have come out onto the streets. I think before the internet most of them would have just done nothing, whereas now they're at least signing the petition. But I think with genuine grassroots campaigns in which the internet is part of it, that's fine. I think if we think the internet's going to save everything and be an alternative to mobilising people and changing people's hearts and minds long term, then you know we're not going to be successful.
To what extent do you think this lack of formal kind of leadership or lack of kind of more defined denominations, how much do you think the media struggle to kind of understand that? Because often when you have these debates where, I mean, often recently things like gay marriage or women bishops, the media for some debate have to have some figurehead big. And the inordinate amount of time it is some right-wing fringe group purporting to be the mainstream, because that's the only person the media can find to actually kind of talk about this particular point of view, because some of the other groups don't have an obvious person to speak to.
Yeah. Thanks very much. I've certainly experienced that. The media like to stick labels on people and say this is the leader of that group, because the media is hierarchical and expects everyone else to be, to some extent. And we need to challenge that, but I'd suggest that one of the problems is that often activist groups are not particularly media savvy and not particularly geared up to dealing with the media. And I don't think that means they need to start getting hierarchical and appointing leaders. I think it means they need to be organised about media, to have rotas for dealing with media calls, to get media training for those members who are willing to do the media activism just as other members are willing to do other forms of activism.
We're looking at Parliament passing some stuff about lobbying. Yeah. And some things I'm hearing seem to indicate that it's actually not going to restrict the powerful lobbying groups, but will actually restrict internet activists far more. Wondered if you had anything to say on that.
I'm certainly no expert on the detail of the proposed lobbying laws. I wouldn't be surprised if the government tries to use it not to restrict corporate lobbyists, but to restrict campaigners and trade unions. I'm worried about corporate lobbying, and I would like to see legislation to restrict it. But actually, it's as much a cultural thing as anything. It's as much what the normal culture is. It's as much the reality that often people who are powerful in corporations and people who are powerful in government know each other. Often they're from the same social and economic backgrounds, and sometimes literally went to the same schools. So I think there's a danger of looking for legislative change all the time when sometimes we need cultural change. But I can't comment on the detail of the proposals because I haven't yet had a chance to look at them. So thanks for reminding me, I need to.
Hi, I've just got back from an extended time in China, and a lot of people in China, they're all on the internet. You'll meet farmers who have an ox tilling their field, but they have a smartphone. And so in China, for those who don't know, they have an equivalent of Twitter called Weibo, which is controlled by the government. And it seems to me the government allow people to rant on this, and it's a vent. It's actually not used to protest, because you can't protest, you can't talk about this stuff, but it allows people to go, oh, I'm angry. They say they're angry, and then they won't do anything about it. So it's used as a vent for people's anger. What are your thoughts on that?
With regards to...
Preventing activism because the people, because they've spoken, they feel that...
I think you're completely right. When you say about farmers in China, I experienced something similar when I was in Palestine in a Judean desert with this Bedouin village. And there's a few goats and camels and so on. It looks like this remote village. And then you see all these mobile phones hanging down from the roof of the tent where they're plugged into the electric sockets at the top of the tent. And it actually enables them to organise their farming a lot better. And it is interesting how internet on phones is empowering people. And it's likely that the next big leap forward in internet access will be caused by the leap forward in the number of people using mobiles. On the particular thing, though, about... you obviously know more about the China situation than I do. I've heard mixed things about Weibo and how people use it. But the people using it as a vent, and of course that happens here as well. People will vent their anger about something and therefore not actually do anything about it. But I don't think the internet's created that phenomenon. Moaning about it in the pub, might be a similar thing. I suspect we all know people, perhaps some of us are people, who moan about things we don't like but don't really do much about it. I think that's a human problem, not an internet problem. Thank you.
Hi, Simon.
Hiya.
Recently, very loudly, we've heard about something we've suspected for a long time, that everything's monitored by GCHQ and other international security agencies. I'm just wondering how you see this having impacted on actions that have already happened, and now it is more out in the open that this is happening, whether that's going to impact on people's engagement with using social media for activism in the future.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you. the revelations about how much internet's being monitored by GCHQ and by agencies in the US and so on haven't surprised me at all. I'm glad they've been revealed. I think in as much as they're happening, the revelation that they're happening is helpful and that it might make people more cautious about how they use the internet, because one of the reasons that the internet is not itself the future of activism or not itself a major salvation is that not only is it monitored by governments, but you know, Twitter and Facebook themselves are major corporations, and both of them have at times bowed to pressure from governments and handed over information or closed down various things. So I think we need to be aware of what we're dealing with. We need to be aware that there's pros and cons to what we're doing and that people are reading stuff. I hope the revelations won't deter people from engaging in the internet. I hope they'll encourage them to engage more carefully. But the I'm still quite shocked that the revelations haven't triggered as much protest as they should have done, because the news that all our emails are either being read or could easily be read by authorities should have the entire population very, very angry. And I'm very, very angry that hasn't been as big a response as there could have been.
Some praise, an observation and a question. I teach digital media at a university which may mysteriously be buying up quite a few copies of your book. I think it's great. Thank you very much. An observation.
I think my publishers do discounts for bulk purchases.
Sorry?
So I think the publisher do discounts for bulk purchases.
Okay, we'll get in touch with them. The observation is that one thing that you said about there's a weak connections and the collapse of denominationalism may possibly be explained by a theory which is also celebrating his 40th birthday this year, called Weak Ties Theory, by a guy called Mark Granovetter, which is in no way a name I had to frantically Google 10 minutes ago. That's the observation. But the question is, should denominations worry about this? I realise this is probably a tangent, but
no, it's not.
Should, say, me, as a vaguely card-carrying Baptist, for what it's worth, worry about the fact that people identify more closely with, say, Anglican mainstream or Christian Voice, please God, not Christian Voice, yes, or similar other campaigning organisations than they do with a church that organises itself under that label? And as a corollary, should denominations change or die? What's the future for denominations?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm aware of Weak Ties Theory, and obviously you as an academic are more aware of the details than I am, but it is, you know, it does describe something that's happening, and you've pointed out the effect on denominations. I don't think denominations should worry about it. I think they should be aware of it. If people do identify more with grassroots groups, whether, say, you know, Christian Conservative Anglican mainstream on the right, or Christianity Uncut, or student Christian movement, or whoever on the left, it's something to be aware of. I suspect most people, it's less a case of identifying with activist groups, more a case of them identifying with their local church rather than with, like, the individual church they belong to. So, you know, Station Road Baptist rather than the Baptist Union of Great Britain or whatever. But I don't know. I'm not aware of the research there. I don't think denominations should be worried about it, because I don't think it's something to worry about. I think God will lead us through different formations, and I think denominational institutions have many, many, many problems, even when they do great things. But I think we need to be aware of it, and denominations talking as if they're not, and sometimes often apparently not being, is what we need to be worried about, rather than the fact that it's happening. Whether we think it's a good thing that it's happening or not, as I say, open to debate, but let's acknowledge it is and not pretend it isn't. I hope that answers your question to some extent.
A little story. Recently in Australia, a rather odious radio presenter called Alan Jones made some rather horrible comments about our then Prime Minister, that her father, who had recently died of cancer, I think it was, had actually died of shame because she was such a bad person, etc. And the Facebook group that grew up around protesting this actually succeeded in pressuring the people who advertised on his show to withdraw all their funding, not forever, but briefly. And I must say I was thrilled because I think he's a horrible man, but I wouldn't be so thrilled if it was a different kind of organisation that was doing this. Do you think there's a potential for the internet promoting mob rule kind of thing?
I certainly think there's the potential for the internet to be used for very nasty ideas, racists, homophobes, misogyny especially, very prominent on the internet. I think there's a sense in which I like the internet being used for campaigns I believe in. I don't like the internet being used for campaigns I don't believe in. And I have a problem with the internet being used for campaigns and not just things I believe in, but are actually promoting misogyny or violence or racism or what have you. But I could say the same not just about the internet, but about print media, about books, about free speech. There's potential for free speech to be used for horrible things, but that doesn't stop me believing in free speech. But yeah, basically, people talked, particularly in the early days of the internet, people talked about whether it was a good or bad thing, which I think was a nonsense question. I think the internet makes things easier. It makes good things easier, and it makes bad things easier. I think that's the upside and the downside of it.
Kind of combines a little bit with what you just asked about mob rule and also a bit about privacy. And basically, I've been an activist quite a long time on the internet, and particularly around refugees issues and youth issues. And I ended up going to the Internet Governance Forum in Azerbaijan. Ooh. And had a bit of a shock that most of the people at this meeting are, from companies and from governments and from, supported by the UN, it's a big talking shop, it has this open model of multi-stakeholder approach that everyone can contribute and talk about how you can regulate the internet and how you can make the internet open at the same time across the whole world. And I mean, it's a massive conversation and there aren't one answer, but it's very, I think the thing that I then went to Lisbon for the European version of this conference, the dialogue on internet governance, and it was the same kind of feeling that it's certain people aren't represented in those things, and that, I don't know, what important, I guess it's almost a statement rather than a question, but kind of both, is how important is it for activists and for people who are at the kind of bottom to kind of make sure that their voice is getting heard in these type of discussions? Most people there were technical people, yeah, or were, people telling me, oh, well, how are we govern the internet in the public interest. Every government can look after their citizens. And I'm there going, but I've been campaigning for refugees. Who's looking after them on the internet? And I think the internet itself and what is going to happen and what rules are going to happen there and the way that law is going to work is going to have to cross boundaries. And I don't think the internet is some kind of separate place to offline, but it's a place which means that I can talk to somebody in another country and we're both bound by our own laws. Yeah. But how do we,
thank you, thanks very much. I think that's a really important question. I think every form of communication that's ever existed that people have used to resist, governments and corporations and vested interests and powerful people have sought to take over, either to restrict the communication, sometimes under the appearance of protecting it, or just because they're getting in on the act and they can make money from it. And let's remember that newspapers, when they began, were really quite a radical thing. They grew out of radical groups in the 17th century producing little pamphlets when the cost of the printing press was falling, and distributing them around. And soon, of course, that got restricted. People tried to control it, but people found ways of getting around it. One of my favourite stories, which is in the book, is from the 17th century, which may be surprising for a book about the internet. After the fall of the Commonwealth in 1660, when Charles Stuart was crowned Charles II and imposed royalist rule again and broke his various promises about religious liberty and so on. His government tried to heavily restrict printing after it had been taking off for so long, and only state newspapers could be published. To print a newspaper, you had to have a license. What they'd overlooked was that the law said it was to print a newspaper. So you had these more liberal newspapers that were handwritten and employed people, speed copyists, to sit there as soon as it was written and copy them out really, really quickly, and then take copies around to coffee houses, which were where people had radical political discussions. And it was a loophole in the law. They were actually reverting to something far more primitive than the technology that had been banned in order to do it. And sorry if that appears to be a digression from the topic, but of course governments and corporations will try and control the internet. My fear is that in 100 years, the internet could be just as heavily under the hands of corporate interests and as narrow as newspapers are now. But like the people in the 17th century coffee houses, we need to use what tools we've got and resist it. And that means not being naive and not being fooled into thinking we're part of some movement to open up the internet when that movement's led by a corporation that's doing it for its own interest. I hope that answers to some extent.
We've got a problem that although lots of people will make a noise on the internet and sign petitions, and often you'll get things like Pat's petition and they get 50 or 60,000 signatures and the government happily ignores them.
Yeah.
And people blame internet activism for this. But then I was in a talk earlier on the Chartist movement.
Yeah.
And they mentioned that there was a petition there with somewhere between 1.9 and 6 million signatures, depending on whether you believe the government or the people.
Okay.
And that was burnt by Parliament and ignored. So it's not a new problem. It seems to be that the government is happy to ignore anyone signifying that they are against what the government's doing, rather than just in the way that they do it. So yeah. I wonder, is there a way that signing your name on a petition, whether it be online or off, will ever be more influential?
Yeah.
Or will we always have to actually take that into people outside wherever the problem is?
I think that's a good point about the Chartist petitions. It's you know, it's not a new problem, mass petitions that get ignored. The a petition is only one tool among many. It's not petitions alone are not going to change the world, whether they're online or offline or however they're done. As for government ignoring people, there's a sense in which the government can only ignore the people as if the people let them, and in Britain we have a tendency of letting them. I think despite that, some things do get noticed, and things like UK Uncut, I'd been moaning about tax dodging for years, and people had produced reports about corporate tax dodging and so on. It took 40 people to walk into a Vodafone store in Oxford Street at the crucial moment. The crucial moment was the government had this narrative of there is no alternative to the cuts, there is no money left. Now, there was all, the deficit isn't particularly big in historical terms anyway, but the narrative of there is no money left was directly challenged by a very well-timed and creative campaign. Now, there hasn't been much progress in terms of actual legal change on tax dodging, although certain things have been changed about the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, but it has become a big issue in a way it hadn't before. So I do think to get some attention, whether that's from government or corporations or media, we need things a lot more creative than mass petitions. Nothing wrong with a petition, but I think it has to be low down the list of priorities for campaigning tools. The example I gave of the Indook and Smith petition, that got publicity and made more people aware of just how little money some people are living on. And that's why it worked better than most petitions, because it wasn't actually just asking for a particular policy change. It was highlighting something and making people aware of something. But of course, it didn't defeat the welfare cuts, and it's only a small part of something bigger. Frustration about government not listening to people I'm as frustrated as you or the Chartists or anyone else, but we need to be creative to have an impact.
You might have slightly answered my question, because my question was about the IDS petition, why you thought that one had the most impact. And while I had the mic, I wanted to plug a petition, not because it's just a petition, because it's part of a wider campaign, but there's a very important petition about the war and welfare called the WOW petition, some of you might have heard of. It's got 4 months to go, and we're 40,000 short of hitting the target of 100,000. So if every person in this room went out and told every person they knew, we might get there. We've got 4 months, and it's a really, really important one, because it would give disabled and sick people the opportunity to ask the government to debate about the impact of cuts on the people who are getting it the worst. So if people could think about that petition. But I was interested in that question.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to say, in relation to that, you've just reminded me, sometimes petitions can be used not to get a specific change, but to get the media to notice something or get somebody to talk about something. In York, there's a... there's a disability and mental health activist Christian called Kerry Owen. Kerry's far too modest to accept this, but she's a sort of phenomenal one-woman campaigning machine. And she discovered that there was a little-known provision that York City Council had to debate any petition that was signed by, I think it was 10,000 York residents or a certain number. And she rushed to get people signing, other people joined in. They got it just in time. The council then had to debate the impact of cuts to disability services and mental health services, it was a Tory-dominated council, they debated it, they dismissed it. But because of that, BBC Radio York was reporting on mental health and disability cuts as the first item on its news bulletin every hour during the day that council debate was happening. The cuts still happen, but a lot more people were aware, a lot more people heard things on the radio challenging the myths and lies about disability benefits. So it's those sort of creative things, such as people like Kerry Owen come up with, can be, you know, different ways of using petitions.
Obviously, you've had a look at a lot of online petitions and campaigns. I was wondering, did you have any advice as to what makes a successful grassroots internet campaign?
Thank you. That's a good question to finish on. What makes a successful grassroots internet campaign? I don't believe in internet campaigns. I believe in campaigns that use the internet as one tool amongst many. And what makes a successful grassroots campaign is if it's genuinely grassroots, if you trust people to do it themselves, if you stand alongside the people who are affected instead of telling them what they need, because change comes from the bottom and never, never from above.
If you want to talk to Simon Moore, there's Twitter, Simon Hill with a Y, and he's signing his book at 5:30 in the Hub.
The G-Books tent.
In the G-Books tent. And I just want to, and I found that really inspiring. I was quite humbled to introduce it. And I just want to say to everyone, I hope you take what he said and we make change happen. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.